Okay, I'm going to stop now. So.
Yeah.
We didn't get the inside here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and then I have to keep changing my slides, right? Okay. Okay.
You're fine?
Yeah, I'm fine.
The pointer is working?
The pointer is working if I go like very near, but I think they'll be fine.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. No, I'm fine. I'm fine. So, yeah, I'm fine. Okay. So I think I'm going to go and start. Okay, I'm Dr. Goswami. Some of you have met me. I'm usually in the diabetes clinic here on Thursday mornings, and the rest of the week I'm actually at NCB. So I was told that some residents have difficulty with insulin, starting insulin, and what doses to start and so on. So I thought I'll give you a brief overview of what to do with, you know, when you want to start insulin, what you should do, and whether it's the right time for you to start insulin, how do you start it, and so on. Okay, a brief slide on the pathophysiology. We all know that 90 to 95% of our diabetics are type 2, and it is a complex disorder. We all know that. It consists of numerous there's multiple abnormalities in multiple organs, and you have mainly insulin resistance starting at the peripheral tissues, which is the muscle and the adipose tissue. This thing doesn't work, okay? And this leads, the insulin resistance leads to compensatory hypersecretion of insulin from the pancreas initially, and then as the beta cells fail, there is impaired insulin secretion, there is an altered insulin glucagon ratio here in the liver, leading to increased glucose production, and this glucose is increasingly produced by the liver, decreased uptake by the peripheral tissue, gives you hyperglycemia, and when there is accompanied with signs and symptoms, we diagnose them with type 2 diabetes. Now, the natural progression, we all know that at the time of diagnosis, we already have 50% of the beta cells have failed. Before that, at least 5 to 8 years preceding the diagnosis, we have your impaired glucose tolerance, where there is already macrovascular changes have started. You have your compensatory increase in your insulin. At the time of that diagnosis, beta cells are failing, and there is your decrease in insulin secretion. You have your glucose levels, which start rising prior to even diagnosis. You have postprandial increases, which is impaired glucose tolerance. This goes on, and at diagnosis, you have hyperglycemia with increasing in your fasting glucose as well. And then, as I told you, we already have changes that have started even way before diagnosis. So at diagnosis, we have to be very aggressive and get patients at goal. Now, this is from UKPDS. You have your beta cell function here on the Y, and your years from diagnosis. So at diagnosis, which is zero, you see that 50% of your beta cells have failed, and as you go along the disease, your beta cells are failing. So when you see a patient, a very important question for you is to ask them, how many years have you had diabetes? Because it makes a big difference on how aggressive you are, what kind of therapy you're going to choose. New onset, very easy to treat. Give them combination and you can bring them to goal. But as you go, as they are, you know, long standing, it becomes very difficult to treat them with fewer agents. So this is when beta cells have failed. Maybe they are 10, most of our patients are above 10 years. And here you have not too much beta cell function left, so it's time for insulin. Okay, so coming in with an A1C of 11%, you have metformin and glyburide with more than 10 years duration, I don't think putting a TZD is going to bring them down to goal. It's time for insulin. Now, there is a lot of, you know, with insulin there is problems with starting because patient is apprehensive, the physicians are sometimes apprehensive as well. And so we have to start thinking about insulin more earlier than we've done in the past. Now, this is the importance of getting patients to goal is because with every 1% decrease in your A1C as shown in the UKPDS, you decrease complications across the board. It's your microvascular or your macrovascular. So even 1% decrease makes a lot of difference for the patient in terms of their complications. Now, this is a one slide that I want you all to remember. This was a study done by Monnier et al. In 2003, where he looked at about 40 patients and checked their blood glucose through continuous glucose, the continuous measurement, CGMS. And what he did was plotted their blood sugars and their A1Cs in 5 different groups. And he showed that as your A1C came down, your postprandials were the highest contributors, while when your A1C was higher, your fasting blood sugars was the higher contributor to this A1C. So when you see a patient and the A1Cs are higher, you target their fastings first. And as the A1C goes down, you at around this level, you might get even fastings at goal, and then you have to target their postprandials because this is the major contributor to the A1Cs. Didn't everyone understand the slide?
What's the mechanism that this occurs by?
Well, in the beginning, initially, you have mostly a postprandial because fastings are still, I mean, I think what happens is, mechanism, I'm not really too sure, but as in the start of the disease, your postprandials are the first, the blood sugars that go up is your postprandials. I'm not sure, I'm thinking about it, but I don't think I'm sure what the mechanism is.
The question though, let's go apart. The point you made is, what is adjusted for duration of disease? So if you have a diabetic mm-hmm. that has had the disease for many years mm-hmm. and his A1C is close to target 7.3, mm-hmm. should you aggressively address the postprandials as well?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Or could that reflect just people who are still early in the disease, so they're...
Okay, yeah, they didn't adjust to mm-hmm. duration of disease, but early on, it's usually the... Usually the, yeah.
So then we would expect to see, or we should maybe have more people on metformin and branding, or...
Absolutely.
If it's
a new onset, yeah, absolutely. If you're coming down, your A1C is between 7 and 8, it's time to target their postprandials. Because those are the ones you'll see that the fastings are actually at goal. So what are your targets? The ADA says your A1C should be less than 7 actually. And your preprandial, which is also you can call fasting, 70 to 130. And your postprandials are less than 180. While ACE, which is down here, they're a little bit more aggressive. A1C less than 6.5. Your preprandials less than 110. And your postprandials less than 140. So you can either go by this or this, whatever you choose to do. Now, although insulin therapy has not traditionally been implemented early in the course of type 2 diabetes, there is no reason why it should not be. And there was one study which just came out recently, like a month ago, in Diabetes Care. Not the best, but they looked at whether you could... they looked at two groups, and they started on insulin on medication-naive patients. One group was oral therapy, one was insulin, and they really saw no change in, you know, the glycemic management. They both reached goal. So there is no reason why you shouldn't use insulin at first, and there are some criteria that you can follow. So over here, which is the algorithm that came out by this consensus statement from the ADA as well as the EASD, this was in 2006, and they had put insulin way up here. Early algorithms don't really bring up insulin this early in the algorithm, but here you can have lifestyle intervention and metformin, your first step, and your second step you can start adding insulin already if your A1C is not at goal. So I just want to show you this algorithm because I want you to understand that insulin can be started earlier on, much, much earlier than we had thought earlier. Okay. So we all know insulin is composed of two polypeptide chains, the A and B linked together by disulfide bonds. Among most species, the A chain consists of 21 amino acids and B of 30. although the amino acid sequences are different species, there are certain segments of the molecule that are highly conserved. Now, it's the most effective agent when used in adequate doses to decrease any level of A1C to the therapeutic goal. Relatively large doses are used in type 2 because of their insulin resistance as compared to type 1s. And in this, I'm really going to only target our type 2 population. Has beneficial effects on your triglycerides and HDL, but can cause weight gain. And an important side effect is, of course, hypoglycemia. And hypoglycemia, you tend to see it more and more as you get more and more aggressive. As your A1C starts coming down, you will see a lot more hypoglycemia. And if you see hypoglycemia when the patients are very hyperglycemic, then it's probably a lack of education on how they should use their insulin and how the insulin works and so on. Now, your ideal insulin therapy would be one which replicates your physiologic insulin secretion, maintains near normal glycemia, minimizes long-term complication, and improves quality of life. Now, this is your physiologic blood insulin secretion profile. Your y-axis has your plasma insulin and your x has your time. So as we're eating, so everybody and in the fasting state and interprandial times, you have some amount of basal insulin. When you eat, there is this first phase of insulin secretion and then there is a second phase that's secreted. Again, you have lunch like now, maybe some people are having the first phases and some may be having the second phases, and then there is dinner. So if you want to mimic this physiology, you have to give someone a basal secretion and then take care of their, you know, postprandial rises either with insulin or with your oral medications, like you had said, you know, something like prandin. So this is your ideal basal bolus insulin. The basal is the one in light blue. And you have your, these lighter ones are your bolus insulin. So this is your basically what you have to follow when you're starting a patient on basal and bolus. Not everyone needs a basal and bolus, but eventually long-standing diabetics will need basal bolus insulin. So what happens in type 2 diabetics is that this is your healthy patients in light pink and your patients with type 2 diabetics. What happened here was they were given an oral glucose load and they had looked at their insulin secretion and their plasma glucose. So the type 2 diabetics, you can see that they have lost their first phase of insulin secretion, and that's why their glucose hangs around much more than the normal people. And this is what you have to replace when you're treating somebody with your insulin. So give them their insulin. An ideal one would be the short-acting insulin that we have now, which pretty much coincides with this first phase of insulin secretion. So this is what happens in type 2. They have a blunting of the first phase. So what are your components of a daily regimen for insulin? Is your basal, which maintains interprandial and overnight glycemic control. So patients who are NPO and going for a procedure the next day, I don't think we should stop their basal insulin, okay? I mean, you have to monitor their blood sugars, but everybody needs some amount of basal insulin, especially your type 1s. Please don't stop their insulin altogether. At least basal, they really need. Now, your bolus, which is also called nutritional or prandial, in different areas you'll see them being given different terms. This controls the post-meal glucose surge. Now, what are insulin analogs? Because right now our insulin is all analog insulins. An insulin analog is an altered form of insulin. Through genetic engineering of the underlying DNA, the amino acid sequence of insulin is changed to alter its absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion. Now, the insulins that we have right now are our rapid-acting insulin analogs. These are a Humalog, which we have in formulary, a Novolog, and glulysine. Start acting within 15 minutes. They peak at about 1 to 2 hours. And our short-acting, which is regular, peaks at about 2 to 4 hours and starts acting within 30 minutes. We have our intermediate-acting, which is NPH. We really don't use Lente or Ultralente anymore. And this has a duration of 12 hours, peaks at about 6 to 10 hours. Now, long-acting, we have our Lantus and Levemir. Lantus or Glargine is formulary here. They do not have any peak. Levemir, you may need twice a day dosing, depending on how much your patient needs. Because as you go up on the dose, you need the Levemir, you may need to split it twice. While Lantus, what we do is up to 100 units, we usually don't split, but after 100 units, you need to split because it's two shots again for the patient, because one insulin syringe holds, 100 units, right? 1 ml is 100 units. So you can split it up. And some people will say that they have problems when they give themselves 100 units. They have some burning or, some discomfort in the site of injection, so you can split the dose. Now, fixed dose insulin mixes, we have Humulin, which is NPH and regular. I think a lot of our patients are on these. The Humalog is 75-25. We have our Novalin NPH and Novalog. These all go according to their pharmaceutical companies. The Humulin is Lilly and Novalin is Novo Nordisk. Now, your insulin delivery devices, we don't use much here, maybe because it's not formulary, but it's a very easy way of delivering insulin. This is what we have now, is the Novalog is now changed to these different colored ones. The green is for Levemir, the orange body is for Novalog, and this is a slightly purple, is the 7030. This is your Lantus Solastar, and this is your Humalog pen. This inlet, which was for NPH and was very easy to use for elderly, because it's got a big dial here, is really going to go off the market. Now, these are your injection sites. Some of you may not be familiar, but most of you, I think, are familiar with the injection site, because when a patient comes to you, you are suspecting some problems with injection. You can actually ask them what are the sites they're doing. And this is around the umbilicus, outer areas of the thigh, outer arms, and then towards the flank at the back. Our long-acting analogs are Lantus, which is formulary I just mentioned. The way that they have changed, to make it more alike to human insulin is that their two positively charged arginine molecules are added to the C-terminus. You don't really need to remember all this, but I'm just telling you because they are analogs. And aspergin at position 21 has been replaced by glycine. Now, how does Lantus work? Upon injection into the subcutaneous space, which is pH of 7.4, the acidic glargine solution, which is at pH of 4, neutralizes and it forms an amorphous suspension. And this results in delayed absorption and an extended duration of action. Now, Lantus, you cannot mix with other insulins, especially not only Lantus, even Levemir, especially because the pH is 4. It's an acidic pH, so you cannot mix these analogs with each other. Now, Lantus has a reduced incidence of hypoglycemia as compared to NPH. So if your patients are on NPH and you're having a lot of hypoglycemic events, you can change them to Lantus. Now, Levemir or Detemir, it's again to the lysine at position B29. A fatty acid has been bound, and after it's absorbed, it binds to albumin. And through this fatty acid, it slowly dissociates from this complex, and therefore the duration of action is longer. Now, NPH, we have it as formulary. It is a suspension of crystalline zinc insulin combined with a polypeptide protamine, and that, therefore it's turbid. Intermediate acting, most commonly used basal insulin, half-life is 8 hours and reaches a peak concentration of 4 to 6 hours. So when you are giving NPH to your patients, you have to tell them that it peaks around lunchtime, and that's the time when if they skip lunch, they're going to go very low. And lots of patients really don't know the mechanism. So if you explain to them a little bit, they're going to know that they shouldn't be skipping their meals, especially lunch. Or even, if they're having very hypoglycemia is midnight or so, you can tell them to check, and if they're really going low, you may be able to change them maybe to something like Lantus. Now, our short acting, our lispro, again, the amino acid has been changed. Lysine and proline residues on C-terminal end are reversed. And what happens in the pedro or glue lysine is that at position B3, it's replaced by lysine, and the lysine in position B9 is replaced. So these are all replaced. Amino acids have been interchanged, and they have different products resembling regular insulin. Aspart or Novolog is again amino acid at B28, which is normally proline, is substituted for aspartic acid. Now, human insulin time action patterns. Your dark blue is your normal insulin secretion at mealtime with your first phase that I told you about. This is the first phase, and this is your second phase. Now, this is your regular insulin. So it kind of misses the boat here because it starts acting about 30 minutes, peaks about 1 to 2 hours, and by then we already have our first phase and our second phase is starting. So most of the time, if you give regular insulin to patients, a lot of them complain of hypoglycemia because it does not really replicate our normal insulin secretion. A rapid-acting analog, if you can see, they act very rapidly and mimics the physiology, the normal physiology. So they have lesser amounts of hypoglycemia. And convenience is that you can, inject and get your plate and eat, while in regular insulin you have to wait about 30 minutes to start eating. Now, this is our analog. Excuse me. This is our analog insulin that's peakless. And then we have our premixes. This is our human premixes that's combined with regular insulin. So you can see again, it does not mimic the physiology. While our analog mixes have a short-acting part, and then you have your long-acting, which is again peakless. So I think the analogs are much better than the ones that we had before. Now, advantages of rapid-acting insulin over regular insulin is that it restores the early insulin peak in combination with meal ingestion, prevents the hyperinsulinemia resulting from the late absorption of regular insulin, and thereby protects against hypoglycemia. So what are your options to starting insulin? You have a patient, very hyperglycemic or not at goal with your oral hypoglycemic agents. So what do you usually do over here? So how do you start? What are your doses? I mean, there's really no guideline, like I was telling the residents a little while ago. Anything you do is fine, but if you have a consensus like this, like you start, if you're thinking of starting a patient on insulin, you can start them on once daily background or basal insulin. If your fasting blood glucose is elevated, but your glucose values remain stable during the day. So you start them on once a day. And a simple and practical approach is to implement once daily basal insulin and continue your oral antidiabetic therapy, titrating according to your fasting blood glucose. But I think the patients who are very more educated and less ignorant, you can tell them that, I keep your glyburide or your whatever sulfonylurea you're using, and if you start getting hypoglycemic events, then take off your sulfonylurea, but don't stop your insulin. So that's the way you can, kind of back off from your sulfonylurea. But when you start, you can start off, put everything together, leave the oral agents, and then start your basal. Whether it's NPH at bedtime or your Lantus, it's fine. Now, you can also do once daily or twice daily premixed insulin analog. Orally administered drugs may or may not be continued. So someone who has, say, postprandial bedtime insulin, bedtime blood sugars are high, as well as fastings, you can start them on premixes, but premixes are difficult to regulate because if you increase the insulin, you're also increasing the form. Do you understand? Because it's a premix of the short-acting and the long-acting together. So if a patient is not eating enough, then they might have hypoglycemia. So this is really premixed. You really have to twist someone's hand to really start that, because it's a lot of hypoglycemia with premixed insulins. So if you don't need to, you should, stay away from premixed. Now, basal bolus is you first initiate your basal, and then you can ask them what's the largest meal, and then introduce your bolus the same way. So oral and antidiabetics and insulin have been proven to be effective in a review of 20 randomized controlled trials, provides comparable glycemic control to insulin monotherapy. And if you use the oral agents as well as insulin, you actually get a reduction in the total daily insulin doses, because you're trying to get insulin and try to correct the decreased insulin secretion while you're using the oral agents like metformin or TZDs to actually target insulin resistance. So it's a good idea to start to keep the insulin sensitizers on board and then start insulin. Now, it also reduces weight gain and helps glycemic control by peripheral insulin sensitization and inhibits hepatic gluconeogenesis. So this is what I just said. Now, how do you dose when you start insulin? Glargine is effectively administered either in the morning or evening, provided the timing of injection is consistent each day. So with glargine, you have to tell the patient to take their insulin at the same time every day. Otherwise, you know, you could get back stacking of insulin if they are taking it at different times. Now, Detemir is administered both once and twice daily. If you higher doses of Detemir actually needs to be split up, and NPH is usually administered twice daily. You can start them at bedtime once only and then go over to morning as well. Now, short-acting analogs are given 5 to 15 minutes before meal, while Apidro, which was glulysine, has been indicated to be given up to 20 minutes after start of a meal. So with Apidro, you can actually give them, if the patient has forgot to take it before, he can give it to himself during, or even, you know, if he's taken it, I mean, if he started his meal, you can still give it to him. So that's an advantage. I think that we've got more and more data that you can do that with all the short-acting analogs. You can give it even after a meal. Now, regular insulin is given at least 20 to 30 minutes before a meal. And where you can help it, I think we need to stop using regular insulin, except in people who are very much used to snacking all day. I think those people can benefit from regular insulin because it's got a longer duration of action. A short-acting analog can be started as a 10% of the total daily dose. Like if you started a patient on insulin, say 10 units or 20 units basal, and you want to introduce a bolus, you can bolus is that prandial. You ask them what's their heaviest meal, and you can start them as a 10% of the total daily dose, and that 10% you decrease from the total daily dose just to keep it constant. Okay, and that's how you can start someone. Or you can just say start taking 2 to 4 units before a meal, and then, you know, as they check their blood sugar, then if they're not at goal, you can go up higher. Like I said, there are really no guidelines out there, but it's there have been studies that are done, and algorithms that were used were 10% of the total daily dose or between 2 to 4 units. So depending on your patients. Now, I'll give you a guide on how to start. Now, with A1C is less than 8, this came out in January of 2006 in endocrine practice. And I thought it was a good idea because you get a kind of a guide. A1C is less than 8%, you can start with 0.1 unit per kg body weight, and that's very, very little. Okay, that's about 7 units for a 70 kilo patient, and 7 units is a drop of insulin in an insulin resistant patient. So you're fine. If you're scared to start a big dose, just start 0.1 unit per kg body weight. If you have higher A1C, you can start 0.2. And if you have really high patient is glucotoxic, then 0.3. But you will see that you're going to need increasing amounts, and we use at least 0.9 to 1.5 units per kg body weight, you know, by the time you get them to goal. Or you can start 10 units per day and then go up according to their fasting blood sugar goal that you would, you know, put down for them. With premixes, you can divide the total daily dose by 2. I think that's what you do. And then use it twice a day. With insulin glargine, it's been recommended to adjust the dose every 3 to 7 days, and initially you have to give them at least 7 days time to start getting adjusted to glargine. Okay?
How does it affect our algorithm if the patients are still on the oral?
oral
anti-diabetic medication.
So how do you start? How do you start?
Do you still start the same? Do you stop some of the anti-diabetic?
Like I said, what you can do is start them on the your low dose insulin, and if they're really educated, or you know, you can tell them that if you start going low, your decrease your sulfonylurea. Usually they're 10 BID of you know whatever. Right, 10 BID. So take off their evening dose, and slowly you take away the sulfonylurea, and then usually keep them on the metformin and TZDs because they are not the ones that cause hypoglycemia. Now titration. How do you titrate your insulin? Well, there is some evidence from these trials that forced weekly titration. You can do it you can do it yourself and tell the patient that, you know, you can either come and see me every week or see the diabetes educator every week and titrate weekly to goal. In the treat to target trial, this was a 24-week trial done with both glargine versus NPH, Detemir versus NPH, and that's where they did, they called back patients every week and they gave them a goal, say fasting is between 100 to 130, that's your ADA guideline. And you would increase your insulin by 2 to 3 units every week. And then there was a patient-led titration. These were Atlantis trial and predictive trial, where they Atlantis was with Lantus versus oral anti-diabetic agents, and predictive was Detemir. And they had two arms where it was physician-led versus patient-led, and it was seen that the patient-led algorithm did much better than the physician-led because patients were doing it themselves. They were going up on their insulin doses every 2 to 3 days by 3 units, and they got to goal, you know, faster than the physician-led. So you can do either. If you see your patient is not really, you know, cannot do it themselves, then you can hook them up to the diabetes educator and get them to come in every 2 weeks or so and titrate it. Or if they're you know, they're educated, you can give them an algorithm yourself and they'll do it themselves. Titration for the short acting, you can do it, you know, you have to check multiple times. That's the problem, is pre-meal blood glucose as well as 2 hour post-meal, and that's how you're going to titrate your short acting. That's what you guys do. Most patients don't check so many times because this will make them check at least 6 to 8 times a day, and that's what they don't do. So what I usually do is introduce it before their heaviest meal, and that way, you know, you get 2 or 3 blood sugar readings for a week or so, say. And when you know that this is what they need, 4 or 5 units, that's what you will introduce for the next 2 meals. So this is a short this is an idea for you to start how you would do it. Okay, here is start with bedtime intermediate acting insulin or bedtime long acting insulin. Initiate 10 units or 0.2 units per kg body weight. Then check fasting glucose, usually daily, and increase dose typically by 2 units every 3 days. Okay, and you do that until you get to target. Then you check A1C, and after 2 to 3 months, if still not at goal, then of course you start checking either pre-lunch, dinner, or bedtime. And if still not at goal at this stage, you will have to start giving them prandial insulin. Any questions on this?
I have a question. When would we start the premix in the night when someone might go hypoglycemic?
Before dinner. Okay.
Versus like doing it starting in the morning before breakfast, where we can.
That's fine. I mean, it's in the trials that have been done, it's been shown to work, and so that's kind of the standard what patients use. But if you feel comfortable. Now, glycemic control is any kind of insulin you use is actually the same. Either you use NPH twice a day, you use Lantus or Detemir, you have same glycemic control. It's been shown in the Treat to Target study, the Laptop study, and the Initiate. These are all studies done with glargine. So glargine versus NPH, you get an A1C almost the same. Glargine versus 70-30 only, this is oral antidiabetics. So these people also had their oral agents on board. Here, no oral agents. So basically, you know, glargine was better because there were no oral agents here. And in the Initiate study, you had glargine 70-30 plus oral antidiabetic on the oral agents, and you got similar control. So anything you use, if you educate the patient on what to do, you're going to get them to go. And this is the translating the slide earlier, is that you get, either you use NPH or glargine, you have similar reductions in A1C. And 58% actually reached goal in the study. So what are the adverse effects of insulin? You have weight gain, and weight gain is seen more with your 70-30, because you're using, I think, more doses of insulin. The more you use, the more weight gain you have. Here it's non-significant between NPH and glargine. You have a lot of weight gain with 70-30 versus glargine. And then hypoglycemic events is less with glargine as compared with your NPH and 70-30. So a few words on this 40 study that just came out in October, a few weeks ago. This was a three-year study where open-label multicenter, 700 patients with A1C levels between 7 and 10% were randomized. They were already on metformin and sulfonylurea. And their outcomes that they measured were their A1Cs, hypoglycemic events, and weight gain. And they were randomly assigned to three groups. They either got biphasic aspart, which is a 70-30 mix, or they got only aspart pre-meals, or they got basal detemir's levemir, once daily, twice if needed. So in the three arms, they saw that their median A1C was similar in biphasic, the prandial group, as well as the basal. And your median rates of hypoglycemia per patient per year were the lowest with your basal insulin. Your biphasic was that 70-30 mix was better than your prandial. So the more insulin you use, the more aggressive you are, you get more hypoglycemic events. And your mean weight gain was the highest with the highest amount you used. So basal was 3.6, with your prandial. The prandial you're using three times per day, and then your biphasic was twice, 6.4, and your basal was the least amount of weight gain. So bottom line is that whatever regimen or whatever insulin you use, you are going to get to goal. But then you have your other adverse effects, is your weight gain and your, you know, hypoglycemia.
The other way around?
Sorry, no.
0.7, 6.4.
Yeah. Your prandial, which you use three times a day, you got the highest weight gain. And your basal was just once a day, and you got the least weight gain.
It should be switched then.
Sorry?
6.4 is more than 5.7, so...
Right. Oh, maybe this was not significant. 5.7 versus 6.4, not significant. So basically similar to both.
They overlap each other, plus or minus, no significant.
It's like regular insulin causes more, actually. It's like regular insulin causes more.
Well, this is not regular. These are analogs again. This is not regular. This is an analog 70-30. Uh-huh. But, of course, more weight gain with your analog plus... This is using more, you know, if you go back to the study and see, they were using much more insulin doses than your basal. Uh-huh. So more insulin on board, you have more weight gain. So detemir has been shown to be associated with less weight gain. So if you have a obese patient and you want to start them on insulin, you can use detemir. It's not formulary here. When it was compared with NPH, you had equivalent glycemic control with less weight gain. And also, this was again two trial study where the detemir had, they both have weight gain, but it's less with detemir. And when compared with glargine too, it had less weight gain. So detemir has a little bit more advantage than your glargine. So conclusions are that insulin analogs offer improved pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic profiles compared with your NPH and regular, and therefore offer advantages with respect to safety, efficacy, and variability. These advantages help your type 2 diabetics overcome some of the barriers associated with insulin initiation, hypoglycemia, and weight gain. Lantus offers a consistent 24-hour profile and predictability, and your lower risk of hypoglycemia when compared with NPH. and therefore facilitates more aggressive titration. Tetramer is associated with equivalent glycemic control, less risk of hypoglycemia, and lower within subject day-to-day control and less weight gain. So anyone has questions?
In practice, that sometimes in the hospital, people are newly diagnosed that maybe with hyperosmolar state or like very, very high
blood sugars.
And then there is this practice of starting both oral agents and insulin. And they say, I mean, I've heard this for a month or two, just to decrease.